Well, hello and welcome to Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and I am very excited to have a return guest this week. And I think that you will find this conversation with Ramesh Panuro, who is the editor of National Review, a longtime, very familiar name and face at National Review, and I think one of the most thoughtful commentators in our day and age about matters economic. He's certainly one of the better economic talents in the National Review orbit, but also in terms of his own social and political commentary. He's a vigorous defender of the unborn and, in his own right, absolutely astute political commentator. But he does write for Bloomberg frequently and has chosen a certain expertise in matters of economics that I think are very valuable, and I enjoyed thoroughly my conversation with him in one of the early episodes of Capitol Record over a year ago about the Fed, about inflation, about monetary policy. So we're going to do the same thing here today, but update where we are with what the Fed's doing right, what the Fed's doing wrong, what critics of the Fed might be getting wrong, and where we would be critics of the Fed, and just kind of unpack all these things together through the very complicated process of discerning monetary policy towards the goal of a free society, an economic framework that functions best for our goal of human flourishing. So with that, let me bring on editor at National Review and my friend Ramesh Panuro. So with that said, welcome to another Capitol Record, and Ramesh actually breaks the streak of a lot of first-time guests we've been having so far this year, because this is indeed Ramesh's second time joining us on Capitol Record. Ramesh, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
This is kind of an interesting conversation for us to have, because I think that there is you and me and about three people left on planet Earth that have a somewhat nuanced view on the current state of inflation and monetary policy, and are not beating the more popular headline drums around the sort of obvious fact that we have huge inflation, and it's obviously going higher, and it's obviously a byproduct of the Biden spending bill and Federal Reserve monetary policy. And the first time I had you on Capitol Record, I think it's a little over a year ago now, we were in a little bit different of a state with data, but our conversation focused on the Fed, but more on what the actual right monetary policy would be if we weren't in the COVID moment, and where we think a lot of people might be getting that wrong. Now, a year later, we know where the Fed is. There's a lot of changes coming, obviously a changed rhetoric. But I wonder if you've changed your mind on any of these key things, particularly the role that the Fed has or has not played in causing the current level of price escalations, and then the role that the Fed would theoretically play in reducing price escalations. Maybe give listeners an update on how you feel on those two things.
Well, I am in a somewhat different place, I think mostly because of the passage of time and changes in circumstances. Last year around this time, I thought that Federal Reserve policy was close to where it should be. As you know, and as we discussed on that previous occasion, I didn't like a lot of things that the Federal Reserve has been doing, but on the basic question of whether monetary policy was too loose or too tight, I thought it was just about right. I now think that in the intervening period, it has gotten more unequivocally too loose, and that they should have started tightening last fall, and that they have they've been a little bit slow, and are being too incremental and cautious right now. I do still think that supply side factors are behind a lot of the inflation. They've proven more persistent than I had hoped that they would be. And I don't think that they are in themselves a reason for any tightening of policy, but I do think that there's now, we've now got a problem on two fronts on inflation now. We've got a demand as well as a supply problem. Now, I still don't think we're in the 1970s by any means, and I'm still holding out hope for the possibility of a soft landing where we get inflation down and we don't have a recession. And if we do have a recession, I'm certainly, I think it's quite possible we have a very mild one. But yeah, that's where I am right now. I think that some of the arguments about inflation can lose sight of some of the different facets of it. Some of the reasons for tightening, if you're a dove, and some of the reasons for not tightening too much, if you're a hawk.
So there's a lot to unpack there. Let me kind of go through piece by piece, and I certainly understand that some of them are interconnected, and so you'll need to overlap with some of these things. Generally speaking, when you talk about supply side source of inflation, I've written extensively over the last year. I've read what you've written. I'm really convinced that there's very little daylight between our two positions, but a lot of daylight between our position and where much of the right is at least talking right now. But I don't think that's true of the economic right. I think it's more the political right, and the political right gets their economic P's and Q's from their political inclination. And I've made this comment to our friend Rich Lowry countless times. It's impossible for me to believe that those who are piling on the inflation narrative as something at Biden's footsteps should be or could be expected to do anything different. It's just too juicy and opportunistic politically. And the fact of the matter is, anything that goes bad in any category when one is president generally gets blamed on the person that is president. But before we go into the Fed, do you believe the $1.9 trillion COVID spending bill, which I think was the fourth spending bill passed total, it was the third of essentially $1 trillion or greater price tag. Do you believe that that bill passed, I think in, was it February, maybe March of last year, is the biggest factor in the present price escalation level? And if not, do you think it's any factor?
Yeah, I don't think it's the biggest factor. I think it may be a factor, and I did... I have changed my mind a little bit on that as well. So my reasons for doubting that it would be a large factor at the start were twofold. One, theoretically, it seemed to me that the argument that there's always monetary offset, that the Federal Reserve is the kind of driver of these things, and if fiscal policy moves expected demand higher or lower than it's supposed to be or than the Fed wants it to be, the Fed will act to change that, and people will expect the Fed to act to change that. That being the theoretical reason, then the practical sort of empirical reason is that we'd had enormous amounts of spending over the last 15 years, bursts of spending that didn't seem to have that kind of inflationary effect. Now, the reason I've changed my view somewhat is I do think that the way – not so much – it's not so much that I think that the money – it was too much spending. I think it was too much spending for other reasons. I don't think that the size of the package was the reason why we had a significant burst of inflation. But I do think some of it was structured in a way that was likely to have an inflationary effect. So, for example, if you are incentivizing people to stay out of the workforce – that's going to decrease supply. If you have other things going on, other stressors on supply chains, in particular markets and industries, you could have a particularly bad problem there. I think that, that there's some reason to believe that the ARP did have that effect. While I still wouldn't say it's the biggest driver, I would say that it has probably made some kind of a contribution.
But see, what you're doing there is making a rational case where there's connectivity to what happened, but not in the same vein as where others go. In other words, I agree 100% that the Biden spending bill exacerbated labor shortage, and the labor shortage contributed to inflationary pressures and still does. But I don't think that's what people are meaning. They are making a monetary argument out of the fiscal, which is that the mere existence of this excessive spending, and particularly the direct payment sloshing around, that it led to a sort of overheated dynamic that had an inflationary component. I'm firmly against that view, but I want to make sure that we're not just agreeing with some of the conclusions, but even the premises along the way, so I don't take anything for granted about your position. Do you agree with me that that element of the Biden spending bill was not necessarily, well, let me put it this way, because I actually wouldn't be opposed to the idea that it creates a initial cyclical inflation, but that I don't believe that money sloshing around sans perpetual velocity creates structural inflation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's right. I don't think that the sort of the simpler argument, you know, sort of it just overheats the economy, and then that sort of carries inflation forward. I don't think that that's right. But as you were saying earlier, it is. Incumbent presidents get credit or blame for economic conditions. And this is a kind of hook for people to use to tie these things together. And, you know, it's not, there are economists who would make that sort of argument, and there are historical precedents for that kind of inflation. I think you put it perfectly, you can't expect people not to adopt this line of attack.
Yeah. So then it leads us to trying to develop a bit more of an economic framework for understanding these things, and so that allows us to be a bit less political, a bit less opportunistic, and kind of do this in a forum like this, a podcast, a conversation amongst two friends, not on Twitter, or in a 30-second soundbite on Fox. And so I found that frustration too, that I do an awful lot of appearances on financial media. And there, in fairness to some of the guests, there isn't the time to unpack it and get into things like velocity and get into, you know, the supply side explanations. But you've used the term a few times, supply side. You've connected labor shortage to that, I think wisely. What do you believe are the primary factors in the current inflation level, other than just a general supply side labeling? Maybe get a little more granular with some of that, Ramesh.
Sure. So I always find that the accounting identity, MV equals PY, is a useful way of thinking about these things, where M is the supply of money, V is the velocity of money, P is the price level, and Y is real output. For any increase in M, or MV, which is nominal spending, you're going to have, you're likely to have an increase in prices. And we've had, I think, an increase in spending. That is what I call the demand side of the equation. The too much money that's chasing too few goods and services, in the famous phrase. The supply side is a change in productivity. It's a change in the relative composition of spending between P and Y. So you can have a supply side inflation where total spending just stays exactly on trend, and it's just you're getting less for your spending because of a productivity decline, because let's say there's a computer virus, or because there's an oil price spike or some kind of shortage like that. And I would say that the inflation that we had, or the excess inflation that we had up through the middle of 2021, appeared to me to be two things. One, that kind of supply-driven, productivity-driven inflation, and then a little bit also of catch-up, that is, an increase in demand-side inflation that I didn't mind, that I didn't think was harmful because it was necessary to get spending back on track. But then since then, I think we've had both of these things contributing. We've had supply side problems continuing and then some new ones emerging. And we've also had overspending where, you know, partly it's, I suspect, just market participants beginning to doubt whether the Federal Reserve was going to tighten quickly enough or enough, substantially enough to bring prices back under control.
And so in that framework, and by the way, for those listening that are hearing the MV equals PY, and you've heard me talk about Fisher's quantity theory of money for over a year in this podcast, and read my Dividend Cafe for many years talking about it. When I say MV equals PT, I'm saying the same thing Ramesh is saying about MV equals PY. The Y and the T are interchangeable around either output, as Ramesh called it, with Y, or the sum of goods and services that can be captured as T. And so there are different mathematical expressions in this identity, and yet they are amounting to the same thing. But Ramesh, you're referring to the demand side as the money supply and its interaction with velocity, and the so-called Milton Friedman wisdom, which I think is unchanged, about inflation being too much money chasing too few goods. And yet one of the big arguments I've made out of Japanification and out of the U.S.'s lessons in inflation are that Milton got to write in a period of stable velocity, and that we simply have not had stable velocity. We've had secular decline in velocity, and there can be a debate on the causation of that. I think I know the answer, but I'm willing to admit that there is differences of opinion among respected economists about what's caused the decline in velocity. But are you more sanguine about the demand side, even apart from the ad hoc situation you describe, post-COVID, reopening, some of the forces that have contributed to demand surge? Do you believe that the declining velocity has been the great untold story of why various monetary machinations, the M, have not equaled a higher P on the other side of the identity?
So I'm
ignoring the Y for this purpose. The supply side, sure, we'll just assume is constant. Okay.
Yeah. Friedman, famously in the 1970s and the early 1980s, advocated a stable rule for increasing the money supply, you know, at a specific percentage, on the idea that, as you were saying, that velocity is stable, and therefore that would lead to a predictable and steady inflation rate as well. And velocity turned out not to be as stable. There have been some attempts to sort of redefine the money supply with various degrees of success, but I think that that's probably the best way of looking at it. And Friedman, to his credit, you know, was adaptable. And I think, you know, if you assume that V is stable, then having steady growth of M is your way of getting steady growth of MV. That is steady growth
because of math.
Total spending. Right. Yes. And I think that fundamentally was the correct goal. Yeah. Now, it's absolutely true we've had declining velocity. Some people will point to some people will take a simpler minded look at this than they should and say, well, all this inflation is obviously just the result of this huge increase in M. And how foolish of the Federal Reserve to think that you could have this increase in M and not have more inflation. But keep in mind that the increase in M is way, way bigger than the increase in inflation. And in fact, there has been a corresponding decrease in V, but it hasn't been perfectly offset. And that difference, the lack of a perfect offset, is how we've gotten increased demand and therefore an increased demand-side inflation.
And so if you go from, let's say, 2003 to 2020, and some started in the 90s, there's some period of time that's kind of immaterial for our conversation about when people want to begin it. My friend Lacey Hunt, who's been a huge influence on my thinking in this, really does believe it started much earlier. I think that the financial crisis is a great time to start it, but there's no question there's some point at which M was absolutely going higher, and inflation was not, and that the velocity decline is the algebraic explanation in there, although it begs the question, what caused the velocity? And listeners already know my answer to that, but I don't know if you do, which is that I believe the velocity is a decline is a direct byproduct of excessive indebtedness in a society, and that U.S. is... situation mirrors that of Japan, only with a lot better circumstances demographically and in terms of economic output and other variables that could make it worse. We haven't been as bad in this category as Japan. Not to mention that, especially pre-COVID, our debt to GDP was exploding, but it wasn't exploding like Japan levels. Even now, we are rightly, I think, infuriated at 130% debt to GDP, and that sits at about half of Japan's 250% debt to GDP. So all that to say, I am wondering if the COVID dynamic changed that mathematical dynamic. And I think part of the problem in answering it is that the T or the Y changed, that we did have steady growth of Y, and then all of a sudden we had an inadequate level of Y to demand. And so now getting into the interaction between M and V has become very difficult. And there are two headline points that are available for those who want them. One was the one we already discussed about Biden spending. I'm not totally sure why Republicans think that Biden's deficit was inflationary, but the rather monumental Trumpian deficits were not. But I'll take that in good faith from folks. The Powell argument that I would make arguments, it sounds like you're about to as well, that are critical of the Fed holding monetary policy as accommodative as it has over the last 6 months. However, the idea that it was what fed the inflation, and particularly the balance sheet expansion, even more than being at the zero bound, I have a very hard time understanding that argument relative to the lessons of QE 1 through 3 and relative to 30 years, certainly 25 years of Japan. So tell me where you think that argument comes from and what you like and don't like about the argument that Fed accommodation, apart from other criticisms, that Fed accommodation was the exacerbator of this inflation.
Right. So there are people who believed that the Fed's monetary expansion and low interest rates following the financial crisis and the Great Recession was going to unleash high inflation. Some people even used the word hyperinflation. And that didn't happen. The theory that an expansion of the monetary base, even a large one, and low interest rates are a recipe for high inflation, I think has been pretty clearly disproven. And you need, but I think that there are people who sort of, you know, they were kind of embarrassed about being wrong, and they kind of went dormant a little bit, but now they can say, well, now we're finally paying the price. Well, there's a theory where, you know, and 10 years later you get inflation is not a particularly compelling one. I do think the Federal Reserve has made some mistakes. Partly it's sort of the way it conducts monetary policy, I think, is too interventionist and too discretionary. And there are particular times when I would have said, I actually thought that monetary policy was too loose for much of 2008 through, say, early 2017. And I think too tight for that period. And then
I assume you mean more in the latter portion, not right 28 to 2014. It would have been pretty hard to get much looser, right?
No, I actually do think that they should have been looser in 2007, 2008, 2009.
Well, not 27. I'm specifically starting it at the point of when they hit zero band.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think that they should have. There are a number of things they should have done, mostly having to do with announcing a policy regime where they were going to. So when I say they should have been looser. I don't mean primarily they should have bought more, or they should have committed to having interest rates lower. I think if they had made a credible promise that they were aiming for a goal of a recovery in spending levels to go back to the pre-recession path, they might not have needed to hold interest rates low for as long.
So label what you're
as many asset purchases.
Label what you're talking about. Are you referring to nominal GDP targeting?
Yeah, nominal spending or nominal GDP level target, where you try to keep that spending level growing at a regular predictable rate every year, say 4.5% every year. And if you are come in too high one year, you try to come in too low the next year in order to keep yourself on that same long-term path. And if you come in too low, as in a recession, you try to make up for it. You overshoot in order to, again, return to that path. Now,
it remeshes their data. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to catch this as you go. I get so many nuggets from you that if I don't interrupt as we go, then I end up with too many at the end to come back to. Is there daylight between your view as you just described it and Scott Sumner's, or are you essentially an adherent there to Sumner's view of nominal GDP targeting as a policy tool?
I do tend to agree with Sumner on most things, and certainly everything that I just said sort of falls right into to what he's saying, and David Beckworth and George Selgin and others, Josh Hendrickson being another person who's been influential for me. Having said that, I think that they've made some mistakes. If you look at the history of the Federal Reserve overall, the mistakes they've made over the last decade have been actually kind of small. I mean, if you compare the disastrous performance of the 30s or the performance of, say, the mid-60s to the early 80s, or I would say 2007 to 2009, for most of this time I've said, yeah, maybe a little looser, a little tighter, do some more of this, do some of that. But nothing as catastrophic as what they've done in the past. And so every once in a while, I have to just remind myself when I've criticized Jay Powell to compare his track record to that of previous heads of the Federal Reserve. And it actually looks, I think, pretty good. But it's still important to criticize them because, they need it.
See, I think, Ramesh, that One of the areas I'd love us to be able to do here in terms of clarity for Capital Record listeners, which I think are intelligent people, and it's a part of National Review where we want people to really dive deeper and not be limited by vocabulary or polarization, binary thinking that is limiting. I think that when people say they made a mistake, that too many people think that means either the rate was too low or the rate was too high. And you've invited a nuance here where when you refer to them potentially post-GFC being too tight, and yet they were at the zero bound, and you're talking about they're using guidance to a nominal GDP targeting, a spending level, there's a nuance there that is not in the lane of interest rates. And so it requires people to kind of be invited into a sort of different level of thinking. But then here's where I do suspect you and I might disagree on something from stuff I've gathered of other writing of yours. It's funny, you refer to the 30s, which is obviously the Depression era, where none other than Milton Friedman on a Schwartz wrote the masterpiece on how tragically ill-begotten their monetary policy was in that period. But you refer to the 60s through 80s, which I assume is the swipe at Arthur Burns for, again, leaving us too tight. And then 2007, 2009, I assume is...
Too loose. You did the same thing I did.
I did, yes. Too loose.
Yeah.
But then 2007, 2009, I assume you believe that they did not get loose enough. They tried to get too tight at the tail end of Greenspan's era and ultimately perhaps added a little bit of pain into what would become the financial crisis. I actually don't subscribe to the view that the Fed's easiness in 2000 and 2004 was a primary cause of the crisis. I do think it put fuel into the fire, that it distorted asset prices, encouraged risk-taking. But even then, there's just such a portfolio of other problems that existed to help cause the financial crisis that I kind of have the Fed pretty low in my list there. But you're referring to the other side, that you think perhaps they were tightening and that helped create a problem. So I happen to not think you're in the traditional, I want to be dovish when they're hawkish camp. I think you have nuance to the view, but I don't think that the nuances get captured all the time. And this is where it leads me to where I think we may disagree. I agree with you that the criticism of monetary policy should not be primarily over the last 10 years that they were too easy, in the sense of that they were causing inflation or that they were that far off the natural rate. But you did say too discretionary and too interventionist, and that's exactly my view. And yet you've been real critical publicly of people like Judy Shelton. I tend to find myself a little bit more aligned with people like Judy Shelton, Jim Grant, but only in the lane of the Fed being too interventionist or too discretionary, and my belief that it distorts asset markets and leads to malinvestment and poor decision-making. So in other words, I feel like there's agreement and disagreement in a Venn diagram all wrapped together, and yet all people want to hear is, do you think the Fed was too tight or not? And so forgive me if there's not a lot of clarity where I'm going with this, but how does one present a more coherent view of monetary policy that allows for critique, but it does, but gets beyond just simply the interest rate?
Yeah. People have varying levels of interest in monetary policy, and you can certainly, some people, and for some purposes, it is completely reasonable to be most focused on, okay, is inflation going up or down? Is the price of groceries going to go up or down? Is the price of gas going to go up or down? And then there are the people who are more concerned about interest rates. And then some of these other concerns, while quite important, ultimately they don't have the same kind of headline power that those other issues do. On the question of sort of the overall sort of monetary regime and the way the Federal Reserve operates, which we both alluded to from time to time, I'm also sympathetic to those folks often associated with kind of hard money and with almost always being hawks when they say we need to have more monetary rules and less monetary discretion. But of course, it matters immensely what the rule is. And what rule is selected, because I can think of rules. I mean, I think the nominal spending rule would make for better monetary policy than we've had. But I can certainly imagine rules that would have made for worse policy than the kind of discretionary policy the Fed has followed. And then there's also the question of sort of whether you want what the operating system should be, and the Fed sort of changed the way it operates over the last 15 years in a way that I think gives it a larger role in the allocation of credit than we would like to see. And so I would ultimately like to reduce the footprint of the Fed. I'd like to go back to that older operating system, but I'd also like to shrink the balance sheet, and move to a more rule-based system. But those are sort of, in a sense, they're long-term, challenges where, you still have to set monetary policy, the right way, to deal with the particular inflationary or recessionary challenges you're facing in the moment.
Yeah, you've really highlighted one of the areas that I've changed on, which is I would have stated earlier in my career that I favored a rules-based approach first and foremost, and that which rule was not super important to me. That whether it was a commodity price basket, gold as a barometer, nominal GDP targeting, once I started reading Scott Sumner many years back. Milton Friedman used to talk about just some really bright kid with a laptop. I favored those things to the willy-nilly of Greenspan and the media making someone a superstar and a maestro, as they called him, that I felt that that was exacerbating boom-bust cycles, and I'd take any rules-based approach to put an end to it. And I do now believe more than ever in rules-based monetary policy. But I agree with you that the wrong rule, and I think you said this, Ramesh, on our first podcast together, the wrong rule ends up leading to no rule at all in the kind of rebellion against what goes wrong with the wrong rule, that it sort of ends up giving the Fed more latitude, not less, as they have to kind of clean up or repair what went wrong. Is that a fair summary of your view? And then what do you think is wrong with, like, let's say the Taylor rule or some of the other alternative rules that are not willy-nilly, Fed has carte blanche, but are also not nominal GDP targeting? Are there other, is that the only rule you like, or are there some you think are better than others?
So the Taylor rule, I think represents an improvement over the kind of ad hoc decision-making of the 60s and 70s, which led to high and highly variable levels of inflation and spending growth. One of the problems with the Taylor rule is it requires you to estimate what the output gap is. That's not just the Taylor rule, but there are other approaches to monetary policy that have that feature. You have to estimate potential GDP. You have to estimate an output gap. And this is, of course, unobservable. And so this creates a source of error and difficulty. And one of the advantages of nominal spending rule is spending is actually easier to monitor and estimate than inflation is. Inflation, requires all kinds of tricky measurement questions. People have been talking about shrinkflation again, as they did in earlier periods of high inflation. You know, if your Twix bar gets smaller and it's the same price, that's still inflation. But a total spending level target where spending rises, 4.5% a year, that's actually in some ways easier. And that's one of the reasons why I favor it, because there's a knowledge problem, right? This is a basic problem of all economic policymaking, that you can't know everything. You can't know every economic variable that is of interest, and the simpler the rule, the better. And then, I just think that, that a lot of the other rules that people talk about, to the extent they work, it's because they're imperfect approximations of a nominal spending rule, right? I mean, which gets you back to sort of what Friedman was talking about. What he was talking about with the stable growth of M was something that he expected to be a kind of proxy for stable growth of nominal spending. And then, of course, it didn't turn out to be. But instead of going for those proxies, I think we should do the real thing. I mean, just to give you another example, because sometimes we can talk about nominal spending and it's nominal spending level targeting as a kind of radical idea. And in some ways it is, but in some ways it is, there are glimmers of it in all kinds of other things that the Federal Reserve does and that other people who talk about monetary policy are talking about. So, for example, when we look at core inflation instead of total inflation, what is that? Why do we do that? I think one of the best explanation for it is you're trying to filter out some supply shocks by looking at the core inflation level. Well, the thing that does that perfectly is nominal spending. A nominal spending target basically says we are going to adjust the money supply solely to offset movements in velocity, and we are not going to take any account of changes in productivity, trends in productivity growth, because we shouldn't.
So therefore, let the economy on its own merits generate productivity growth, and fiscal tools can play a role in that or not. For me, those fiscal tools would only be on the supply side, deregulation, marginal tax relief. But for others, it could take a more Keynesian approach. The point being, this version of monetary policy would strip away those fiscal assessments from the way in which monetary policy was administered.
Yeah, so you have 4.5% spending growth, and let's say you've got a high productivity year. There have been great technological advances, the diffusion of that technology, and you've got 3% real growth that year. Well, then you've got 1.5% inflation if you've hit that target. You've got lower inflation. Prices are a little lower than they otherwise would have been because you've got that extra productivity. And on the flip side, if there is a, if there's a, you get a return of the oil embargoes of the 1970s, that manifests as a reduction in the productive capacity of the economy. You're producing less and prices are going higher. Somebody, I forget who it was, maybe it was George Selgin, said, formulated it very nicely the other day. Like, you shouldn't respond to a scarcity of goods with a scarcity of money. And if you try to have monetary policy prevent a supply-driven inflation, that's what you're doing.
And so you and I are on the same page that in this current environment, there are other reasons that the Fed should be seeking to normalize some aspects of monetary policy, get off the zero bound, reduce balance sheet. But let's just say there weren't. Let's say there was other economic factors that would cause us to believe that monetary policy was not too loose and was appropriately accommodative. And yet used car sales went up 30% last year, used car prices. Isn't that a great example where the Fed could be making a policy mistake around a supply shock totally unnecessarily? And in this case, I think would be making that mistake if it were not for the fact that there are other criteria driving a monetary change.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a supply-driven inflation in some ways, and this is part of the what makes these things sort of tricky and hard to think about, in some ways it's worse than a demand-side inflation because it's kind of all loss. It just is the result of a blow to output. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be concerned about it. I'm not saying there shouldn't be a policy response to it. There may very well be policy responses, you know, from automating the ports to getting rid of the Jones Act that would have an effect.
Or maybe labor shortage factors that you brought up as well.
Right. Yeah. But it's not a specific monetary problem. And there's a limit to what monetary policy can do and what monetary policy should try to do.
And the proof of that is in the way people answer this question. I've asked this 1,000 times, playing devil's advocate. If the Fed funds rate were 150 basis points right now, a full 125 higher than the current target, 6 rate hikes from where we were a month ago, how many ports in Long Beach would be reopened? Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, nobody could credibly say it's any different. It would be any different. There'd be more ports, more truck drivers, more imports coming from China or South Korea or Vietnam, that essentially every aspect of the why that is constrained right now, the supply side would be the same, even if the Fed funds rate were exponentially higher. You would agree with that, I assume?
Yeah, that's right. And to return to something that we were talking about earlier, and I think that some of those things both reflect actions and inactions of the Biden administration, for which it can fairly be held accountable. That, you know, the sorts of things that you would need to do to address those problems are kinds of things that Democrats are sort of congenitally averse to doing, because their whole model of economic policy in any specific sector is to pump up demand and restrict supply. And that's what they do in healthcare, and it's what they do in childcare, and it's what they do in housing, and on and on. And so I think there's a reason why this administration has seemed particularly flummoxed, even beyond the way the rest of us have been flummoxed by inflation.
So this sort of indirectly brings up one of my biggest concerns about the present conversation, particularly on the right, is I fear that this very important thing you bring up will get lost. It's my belief that we do not primarily have monetary-driven inflation right now, but that for over 30 years, we have had price inflation in three elements of the economy that are substantial because of policy mistakes and policy failures, and that is housing, healthcare, and college tuition. And that all three are directly related to the subsidies they receive from the federal government. And that in talking about the monetary inflation now, blaming the stimulus spending bill, blaming Jay Powell, blaming the Fed funds rate, that when we inevitably start getting disinflation, we will take our eye off the ball of what we have not cured, which is the subsidy problem feeding those pockets of the economy that are in fact subject to policy-driven inflation. Am I wrong?
Yeah. I think that even in low inflation, overall inflation periods, we have not devoted enough attention to it. I think of them as three H's, you know, health, housing, higher ed. Those are all areas where you've got the same basic policy model. The politics of each of them are a little bit different, but the policy model is you have subsidies that increase demand, and then you have all kinds of restrictions on supply. That is, of course, a formula for price increases. And I do think so. Here's the more positive way of looking at it: that the increase in inflation could become a reason for conservatives to advocate a cost of living agenda that specifically addresses those factors. And uses the sort of this moment of heightened concern of inflation to do that. Of course, you're looking at me a little skeptically on that, and I can understand that. But I think that
you said it. You said it earlier.
Thing we can do.
You said it earlier, not me. Knowledge problem.
Right.
That would be tough.
But I do think, you know, there is the potential. There is the potential to move a little bit on housing. I think there's been some interesting work done by people on the left about that, and some interesting things happening even on a pretty small scale, even in California. But those are places where I think we have to tackle these big problems.
Yeah, no, I agree, and it kind of invites a whole nother conversation. But it's I think you're right that. It seems that when we get one area of this overall discussion wrong, that we're very likely to miss some other things as well that are probably important in an overall macroeconomic landscape. And so, you know, for me, I think what I'm trying to do, I believe in a lot of ways the right is still struggling with the problems of post-war economic policy, that the political right, when you think of a kind of three-legged stool conservative, was so incredibly focused, rightly so, on the Cold War, on being good, staunch anti-communist, and on social policy as the attack on the unborn and various aspects of religious freedom, right kind of took on certain priorities and outsourced some of our economic thinking not so much around limited government and rule of law and, you know, some of the more basic elements, but I think monetary policy was often picked up by fringe elements, and that we have not had a real intellectual foundation within right-wing political economy that people could look to as to how does this integrate, whether it's in a Chicago school or Austrian school or just overall classical economic framework. The supply side school that the Laffers and others made so relevant politically, it was pretty limited in its agenda, which was a deregulation and a reduction of tax burden, all of which I would overwhelmingly support. But I think my agenda, Ramesh, is that we are still looking at every single thing that goes wrong as it were the 70s. You hear this talk now. We're hearing people say we're in stagflation with 3.8% unemployment. And the 70s was dealing with almost 10% unemployment. And so I just feel that I want the credibility back on our side. I think that the Hayeks and Friedmans and von Mises, and if you go back to the 19th century and 18th century, I can give more names there as well. I think these are our people, yet we have really been asking Larry Summers to come pinch hit for us when it went, you know, there's sort of truth to Nixon's dumb line about we're all Keynesians now. You know, a crisis comes up and we all look to Jay Powell and say, what are you going to do? And I just believe that we have to do better, and that's a big part of what I want Capitol Record to be about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also just a simple matter of, look, conservatives, when did conservatives really pay the most attention to the Federal Reserve and monetary policy? Late 70s, early 80s. There was an inflation problem. There was an intellectual and policy problem. And the solution was, in fact, more monetary tightness. And then that was implemented after a lot of controversy and fights, and it succeeded. It succeeded, you know, pretty dramatically, swept everything before it. And then people just, and conservatives, most conservatives just stopped paying attention to monetary policy. And so it's sort of like it's encoded in the DNA. That was a formative experience for modern Reaganite conservatism. And then so when the Fed's back in the news and it seems to deserve attention, that's your reflexive answer, right? Your reflexive answer is if things are going wrong, they need to tighten their policy. And sometimes it's even the correct answer, right? I mean, as I believe it is right now. But that can't be sort of, you know, the entirety of your analysis, and it can't be true at all times.
Well,
right? That's also how you get the mistake of thinking, you know, the Fed's too loose in 2008, which ends up being a disastrously influential line of thought.
But if we were critical of certain aspects of monetary policy, the late 70s, early 80s, and then we say, well, the supply side revolution from Kemp through Reagan, combined with Volcker and his monetary efforts, they helped break the back of inflation. And then we got all this output surge, and the conservative economic framework looked really good for a long time. I'm pretty open to that narrative. But see, it does seem to me that post-crisis, and this is something I've never talked to you about, and I've talked to Judy Shelton about it quite a bit, because I think she's one of the few that gets this, that we can talk and be right or wrong on rate policy and balance sheet. But post-crisis is the first time we started creating all these special purpose vehicles. The Fed-Treasury Accord went to a new level when the Fed now was invited to basically manipulate the system pretty legally by letter of the law, but totally illegally by any reasonable spirit of the law, to buy in post-COVID junk bonds, municipal bonds, commercial paper, the vehicles that were used to help buy agency mortgage bonds post-crisis, and even commercial mortgage back. I think that that there's no framework in place to evaluate the Fed for what it has become. We're still talking about the Fed in a 1970s context.
Yeah, we've alluded to this problem, and I think that that's right, and that probably is a place where I agree with Judy Shelton, whom I've otherwise been pretty critical of. I don't like the those special vehicles. Frankly, I think, you know, one of the other interesting things about the sort of Scott Sumner ideas about monetary policy is that they lead to a lot less intertwining of the monetary and banking system in an odd way, right? The Federal Reserve would probably if we were living in a kind of nominal spending targeting world, and especially if we were implementing that through the use of futures markets, we would separate out the financial regulation aspects of the Fed altogether from monetary policy setting, let alone having all of these kind of credit allocation special vehicles.
And so it sounds like you're sympathetic to my view there, that even with a little bit more tolerance for some monetary periods of monetary accommodation than many on the right are comfortable with, you are all equally uncomfortable with the Fed playing the role of business cycle arbitrator in credit markets in particular, that those interventions you view as a bridge too far.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I do think that I just want the Federal Reserve to keep spending growing at a steady rate year after year after year. I want it to be a very, very boring job. I don't want markets moving based on things that chairman of the Federal Reserve are saying. The most I want them to say is something like, well, it was 4.6% last year, so I guess we're going to have to go for 4.4% this year, and press conference over. Anything that shrinks the footprint in a way that is conducive to a monetary system that just facilitates exchanges in a predictable way, that's what I want.
Well, and I agree 1,000%. You're even using some of the same language I would want to use to codify the view. And I think from a financial market standpoint and someone who runs an awful lot of money for a living, I think that the problem is not only what you're saying about the Fed influencing markets, but it's that the Fed then invites people to front run it. And so you end up getting financial decision making that is not driven by what the Fed will do, which is bad enough, in my opinion, because I want decision making around profitability of projects, goods and services, productivity, things like that, a sort of profit and loss assessment. Not only do we invite the distortion of people having to guess what the Fed will do, but you get people having to guess what people will guess the Fed will do. And so it adds a whole layer of non-productive economic activity into financial markets.
Yeah, I think that's right. And just adds a level of unpredictability also, which, you know, it ought to be one of the principal aims of monetary policy to not add.
To not exacerbate what is already an uncertain world, adding another level of uncertainty into economic calculus seems like a bad idea. Ramesh, I've done my very best to find some stuff for us to disagree on, but the best I came up with is you use the letter Y and I use the letter T in quantity theory. So I think we've done pretty well here at staying simpatico, my friend.
Well, it's your fault for being so sensible.
Yes. Thanks so much for joining us, Ramesh, and I hope you'll come back again for more chat here on Capitol Record.
Thanks. I look forward to it. Take care.
Well, look, I know what you're going to say. It was a lot to chew on. It's very hard for me to have a conversation like that in only 45 to 60 minutes when I want to do it over multiple hours. And it's hard to systematize things because the conversation leads to different strands and important tangential discussions. And so we kind of went all over the place there. But I want to just really bring it together with a couple of the areas of significant agreement. Ramesh and I are two guys on the right that are pretty united in A, being critical of certain aspects of the Fed, but B, being critical for maybe different reasons than some of the lazier analysis out there lends itself to. I'm probably more critical than Ramesh is for some of the abuses of intervention and distortion and ill-thought discretion that the Fed has taken. I am really quite obsessed with where the Fed has invited distortions into capital markets and exacerbated boom-bust cycles. But as it pertains to the Fed's role as a central bank, imagine that, the lender of last resort, and the role the Fed has in utilizing monetary policy to affect its policy aims, I am pretty much in total agreement with Ramesh about so much of what he has said, that right now we face an inflation that is far more supply side oriented, and that has very little to do with the monetary policy. And yet, there are many other reasons why I believe the Fed's in need of normalizing, not the least of which is the fact the Fed has, at this point, lost its ability to react to future crisis and future macroeconomic shocks that are all but inevitable in the course of history. So, look, there's a lot you can chew on there. I hope you'll reach out with your questions. It goes in a lot of different directions, but digest it, take it in, and then hate us or love us or somewhere in between. But whatever you do, don't stop listening to the Capital Record.